Ezra chapter 4 and verse 1 says, "Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, 'Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we have sacrificed to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here.'" Now, if you remember last month as we went through the third chapter of this book, we saw there in Jerusalem the start of a very significant work of God in that city. The exiles have returned after a long, drawn-out period of captivity in Babylon, and they've come back after a long journey, over 40,000 of them gathering as one man to start the work that was before them. The altar was rebuilt, you remember that, and sacrifices were being offered once again, and proper worship was reestablished for the Jewish people, and celebration was happening. And this chapter 3 was really something. I just read this morning in my devotion, Psalm 126, and the first two verses describe the atmosphere that was there in Jerusalem. It says, "When the Lord brought back his exiles to Jerusalem, it was like a dream. We were filled with laughter, and we sang for joy." Now you remember as the chapter closed, there was a few of the older men who were there that could still remember the old temple, and it says they were weeping, but that the sound of the weeping and the sound of the shouts and the rejoicing was kind of intermingled, and so it just made one gigantic resounding noise throughout the land. By the close of the chapter, the foundation of the new temple was being laid there. And it's the last verse that tells us, "All the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard afar off." And now chapter 4 begins, "The adversaries heard that they were building the temple." The enemies of Judah has found out what's going on. And that sets the stage for what we find in chapter 4. The adversaries have come into focus now. And this should surprise nobody here. Not anyone who serves the Lord, anyway. Because anybody who serves the Lord with any level of commitment at all knows that there is no substantial work of God that goes uncontested. Those of you that have been serving the Lord for any length of time, you know how hot it can get, how problematic it can become, and how mysteriously challenging it is, and you don't know why. Well, we can chalk that up to our adversary. It's always going to happen. And Paul recognized this, and in 1 Corinthians 16:9, he says, "A wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries." It's always the case with us as we serve the Lord. We too have an adversary, maybe not the same ones that the Jews were dealing with particularly in this chapter, but we do have one. And 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8 says that the devil is our adversary. He prowls around like a roaring lion. And so now as we come to chapter 4 of Ezra, we have a lot to learn here about how the devil opposes the work of God, because there's a lot of similarities between the adversaries of the returnees from exile and what we deal with today. But the interesting thing to me is that Ezra, as he writes this chapter, doesn't mention the devil at all. He doesn't incite Lucifer's name. Satan isn't referenced throughout this entire chapter. But what we're studying tonight has every bit to do with how Satan works in our lives, because an adversary is an adversary. Anyone or anything that attempts to stop the work of God is not of God. And so we have a lot to learn tonight about the work of Satan in our lives. But what we're studying here isn't just how the devil works, but how the devil works through people. So this is important for us, because the devil isn't going to show up on your doorstep wearing the typical red spandex that we see in pictures with the pitchfork and the tail. He's not going to appear in the way that you would think. Oftentimes, he works through people. In this chapter, they're called adversaries. We aren't told exactly who they are, so we need to answer that question. We do know who they are with a little bit more exploration. Who were these adversaries in verse 1? Well, what you need to know is that it was, I think, about 100 years before Babylon took the southern tribes of Judah captive. Okay, so this is 70 years ago, and then another 100 beyond that. The northern tribes of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, were conquered not by Babylon, but by the Assyrians, who were 100 years later conquered by Babylon. So the Assyrian Empire was responsible for conquering and exiling the northern tribes before Babylon was ever in the picture. And when that happened, they deported the majority of the Jews from those northern tribes, leaving behind only a remnant of them, and they repopulated the entire area with foreigners. Okay? These foreigners intermarried with the Jews. Generations have passed, and now they're mixed. There's just a whole conglomerate of nations with the Jews interspersed among them. These were now the Samaritans. That might ring a bell if you're familiar with New Testament times and the relationship between the Jews and the Samaritans that had developed such hostility between them because of the things that we're reading about in this chapter. But these Samaritans were really, if we want to be practical about this, were distant relatives of these Jews that had returned from Babylon. Distant relatives. Only partly Jewish. Mostly not, but partly. They were the friendly neighbors to the north who, in verse 2, claimed to worship God and came down to just help build the temple. I'm sure they smiled and shook hands and hugged, and we're here and we have God in common and we want to help with the work. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 24 says, enemies disguise themselves with their lips, but in their hearts they harbor deceit. Though their speech is charming, don't believe them. What appears to be friends in verse 2 are adversaries, according to verse 1. I want you to notice the impression they're hoping to make. They come down there and they insist that they're religious, that they're devout, and that they worship the same God as the exiles do. They're trying to make friends. They're trying to become acquainted. They're trying to get in, is what's happening. If you'd like to turn back to 2 Kings chapter 17, we can learn the truth about these people. It's recorded for all to see if any attention is being paid. This would have been written down even in Ezra's day, so this was available to anybody who was willing to do their homework. But in 2 Kings chapter 17, we learn whether or not they're telling the truth about how religious they are and how devout they are and whether or not they worship the same God as these who have returned from Babylon. In 2 Kings chapter 17, if you look at verse 24, this is how it began. The king of Assyria has conquered the northern tribes of Israel, deported most of them, left the poorest of them in the land, and then, in verse 24, brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. Okay? So here he's emptied out all of the Jews except for a remnant, and then he's repopulated it with all these foreigners, Babylon and a bunch of other nations that we've read here. And it was so, at the beginning of their dwelling there, that they didn't fear the Lord. Of course not. They're foreigners. They don't know the God of Israel. That's why the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you've removed and placed in the cities of Samaria don't know the rituals of the God of the land. That's why he sent lions among us, and indeed they're killing us because we don't know the rituals of the God of this land. And so then the king of Assyria commanded and said, send there one of the priests that you brought from there. Let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land. So then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. However, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in the shrines on the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. And the men of Babylon made Succoth, Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nebaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrimelech and Anamelech and the gods of Sepharvim. And so they feared the Lord, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places, who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. They feared the Lord, yet served their own gods, according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried away. To this day, they continue practicing their former rituals. They don't fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes or ordinances or the law and the commandments which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. So they come down now in verse 2 of our chapter this evening saying, we worship the same God. We've been sacrificing to him ever since the beginning. Is that true? 2 Kings 17 clearly says, no, they don't. I mean, yeah, they kind of do. They go through the motions, but it's a conglomerate faith. It's polytheistic. God just got borrowed, lumped in with a whole bunch of demon gods just to keep the lions off their backs, literally. That's all. So when they come down insisting that, hey, we have faith just like you. We believe in the same God. We're as devout as anybody else. What a person says of themselves isn't always what God would say about them, is it? Certainly not the case here. They're boasting of themselves as if they were some bastion of spiritual fortitude. No, they're not. That's not how God sees it. Verse 34 of 2 Kings 17 says, they didn't fear the Lord at all. They were polytheistic. The question for you and I this evening is whether you naively trust what other people tell you about themselves. Do you? You just take people at their word? Or do you evaluate their life and their past and their character? The Jews here that are trying to rebuild and do the work of God can't afford to be naive. Are you so desperate for their partnership that you've overlooked a whole mountain of evidence against them? You want to play fast and loose with relationships like that, the one to whom you yoke yourself will ultimately destroy the precious thing that God has called you to build with your life. I hope Israel realizes this before they make a partnership with these Samaritans. So don't lie to yourself and pretend that your adversaries are allies just because they claim to honor God and promise to help. The devil never introduces himself as an enemy. You know that, don't you? He introduces himself as a friend. I've already alluded to that. 2 Corinthians 11:14 confirms, telling us that Satan actually disguises himself as an angel of light. So it's no surprise that his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. In other words, if you want to find out who really serves Satan, don't go to the Satanist club. Come to church. You'll find them here. People who do not worship the same God that we worship. They aren't as devoted as we are. They are not sacrificing their lives to the right cause. They were sent here by their father, the devil, to be planted among us as if they were wheat when they're nothing but tares. That's what the devil does. He sows tares among the wheat. So this is where they're found. And I'll tell you that Satan is not opposed to using nice people, neighborly people, or even your own relatives to interfere with the work that you're called to do for God. He's not opposed to doing that at all. In this chapter, it seems to be his first choice. How does he do it? How does he use nice people in the lives of God's children in order to defeat their purposes and stop the work of God? By building together. By convincing the children of God to partner with them and build friendships together, build families together, build their life together, build their future together. Because Satan knows that if he can employ his own people to assimilate themselves into the fabric of whether it's Jewish society then or Christian culture now, they will, over time, introduce alternative gods to worship, foreign customs, pagan practices, whatever the case may be, to weaken your devotion to God. And the truth is, then as well as now, the greater effect is going to be felt by the next generation, not this one. If we let people in who aren't of God, we might not feel the pain as much as the next generation. It's their children that are going to suffer, guaranteed. Their children. Because this generation will get all the help they need in rebuilding the temple. It will be wonderful, a little bit of compromise, but that's okay. Next generation, the children will be intermarrying, and it won't be long after that before they're steeped in polytheism again, and they're back to square one before they were ever exiled to Babylon. Why did they get exiled? Because of idolatry. And you know what the Bible tells us? I think it's 2 Peter 2:20, that if you escape the corruption of the world only to get ensnared in it again, you're worse off after having come to a knowledge of the truth than you ever were before. And so we make it worse for our children and our children's children than we had it. And if you're a Christian and you can remember how bad you had it, you might think twice about partnering with those who do not love God. Satan works through people who pressure you into compromising your convictions. This is how he has always attempted to stop the great work God is attempting to do through his people. Satan has his own people, and this is his strategy. They say, "Let us build with you," in verse 2. Let us, it almost sounds like a proposition. Let us build with you. But in the original Hebrew, it's, "We will build with you." It's a much stronger statement than it reads here in our English. We will build with you. It's more of a demand than a request. So these people are muscling their way in. Remember, they're adversaries. Let's not be fooled. You know what the Hebrew word for adversary is in verse 1? Tsar. Do you know what a tsar is? You guys, yeah, take world history in fourth grade? Tsar. I don't know that there's much of a parallel, but it's interesting because the czars came about in the 1500s, 1600s, and 1700s in Russia when that title was given to the supreme ruler, starting with, guess who? Ivan the Terrible. And the word czar is actually a derivative in Latin of the word Caesar, which kind of speaks to the adversarial nature of one with this character. But here, the word is tsar, and it speaks of a narrowness or constriction. It is referring to one, when it's spoken of an individual, as it is here, or a group, those who apply pressure, opposition, and thereby cause sorrow, distress, and anguish. And so the Jews here, by their adversaries, are being made to feel as if they have little choice in the matter. They're muscling their way in. We will help you rebuild. And so this is pure pressure at its best. You can imagine the scenario. They're mixing mortar and laying bricks, and here comes these guys. Here, move over. We're helping. We're helping. And pushing their way in, and they're going to do this now. And so the Jews have to make a choice here. Their adversaries are now deciding for them how things are going to look. Listen to me, dear Christian. You and the people you love are in great danger when somebody else who's already proven their hostility to God in times past starts to apply pressure and dictate the situation. You better take note of that before it's too late. In verse 3, Zerubbabel, Jeshua the priest, and all the rest of the leaders spring into action. It says that they said to them, "You may do nothing with us to build the house for our God. We alone will build to the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." So Zerubbabel and the rest of the leaders there, they had discernment. But more than that, they also had the courage to deny the offer that was being made. And I'm guessing that it would have been a tempting offer. Like, how badly did they want to build the temple? You tell me. You remember chapter 3? They just laid the foundations, and they were screaming so loud that it was heard in distant lands. They wanted this to happen. And so now help is being offered. Free labor. They want to partner with us. They're at least related, distantly. Maybe we should let them. I'm sure that there would have been an appeal to the offer that was being made, but they would not have it. Proverbs 14:15 says, "The naive believe everything, but a sensible person considers his steps." Think about it. And what I like here about Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the leaders was that they were unanimous in their decision to back out. Across the board, everybody voted to back out. They were a united front. That's important. And they were unwilling to compromise. Not at all. Not for a day. And so they refused to partner with them in that work. And the message that that sent to their adversaries, because that spoke to the adversaries, didn't it? I mean, when you say, "Nope, you're not helping with us. We're doing this by ourselves. No, no, no." Well, that sent a message. And that message was exactly what was needed in order to reveal the true hearts of the adversaries who presented themselves as friends. And here's where the devil starts using those same people, only in a different way now. Okay? "Oh, I couldn't get you to compromise? Okay, we're going to switch things up, and now my people are going to be attacking you from another angle." Okay? So in verse 4, it says, "Then the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah. They troubled them in building and hired counselors against them." They're like lawyers. They're suing them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Okay? So apparently, the way Zerubbabel and his team handled the situation revealed the truth about the Samaritans. Okay? Now they're hostile. These are the same people who only two verses ago claimed to honor God. These are the same people who only moments ago were kindly offering their assistance. I find it interesting how quickly Satan's man can go from cooperation to opposition. "As long as you do what I say and let me run the show, we'll be buddies. But as soon as you refuse to give me what I want, you're on." 2 Corinthians 11:13 says, "Such people are deceitful workers." They're deceitful workers. As soon as they aren't given what they want, they actively try to stop the work that they only recently wanted to help with. It's amazing to me. They weren't devoted to God at all. They only wanted to add the worship of God to what they already had. Again, polytheism. They aren't worshipers of God. They're worshipers of everything life has to offer. And God considers people like that adversarial to true Christianity. Take note of that, because the modern church is no stranger to these kinds of people. The modern church is not unfamiliar with this kind of a situation, at least those in the church who have their eyes open. But if there's anybody here in 2026 who's really done nothing but add Jesus to what they've already got, let me be clear with you, this church has no interest in partnering with you. We don't want your help with God's work. He's called us to do something special, and it's for us, not you. We don't want you to serve with us. We don't want you to become a member. Why? Because you're polytheistic. The same thing that is true in Ezra's day holds true today. The church can't afford to let everybody in. 2 Corinthians 6:16 asks, "What union can there be between God's temple and idols?" So if you're polytheistic, and what I mean by that is you've simply added Jesus onto the top of your life, an already crowded life, then this is not for you. If you're committed to multiple causes in life, if you're open to a number of different options for your future, rather than finding and doing God's exclusive will, or if you sacrifice what's yours to a number of different things, all of which compete with Jesus for your time and attention, then we can't afford to partner with you. Because the Bible says, regardless of how friendly you appear or how helpful you might be, you're our adversary. Okay? 1 John 4:1 tells us that we're not to believe everyone who claims to be spiritual. We're supposed to test them to see if the spirit they have actually comes from God. Why? Because there are many liars in the world. It's just the way that it is. I'll bet you that when Zerubbabel and company stood up and said what they said to the Samaritans, all the Jews behind them went, "Thank you for taking that position. We feel safe under your leadership." And I'll bet you everybody on the receiving end of those statements was like, "You know what? Screw you. Where do you sit today?" Are you like, "Ooh, Justin's mean. Ooh, Justin's just, ugh." Or are you like, "Thank God that we have leaders like Justin and Adam and Jason who will take a stand and say, no, you can't be a member. No, you can't serve here. No." Well, the greatest threat to the Jews at this point in history wasn't Babylon or Assyria anymore. It was people who were halfway Jewish. And it isn't the Muslims or the Hindus that are destroying the modern church in America. It's the halfway Christians, right? The lukewarm, that's what Jesus calls them, the lukewarm. And it's partly because the church has failed by letting them in and keeping them around. And you know what I'd ask of you? Maybe you're one of the Jews behind the leader today, and you're going, "Thank God that we have a church like this that takes a stand. I mean, we don't want to dilute the work of God. We want to see what we can do with our life, and so I'm glad that I'm part of that." Great. Are you glad that you're a part of that? Let me ask you this question. Who are you letting in? Are you bringing lukewarm people in? Are you partnering with others and then bringing them into the church? Like, right now, everyone here should ask themselves, who's lukewarm in my life? Who am I partnered with? And how close have I gotten? Are you protecting yourself from dangerous friendships? And what are you doing to protect yourself from dangerous friendships? Regretful partnerships or heartbreaking marriages, compromised ministries. What are you doing to protect yourself against those? Again, 2 Corinthians 6 says, "Don't be yoked together with unbelievers." Verse 17 says, "Separate yourselves from them." You need to get away. So if I may, I would suggest to you this evening that there are people in your life right now who would claim to love you and who would claim to honor the same God you honor and would claim to be looking out for your best interests, but they don't love you and they're not honoring God. And you would never know that until you stop playing by their rules. Then it'll become clear. And I think that part of the reason God allowed his people to face discouragement, trouble, and frustration, as it says here in verses 4 and 5. Part of the reason God allowed his people to deal with all of that from the Samaritans is so that the truth would come out. I think God let this happen. I think it needed to happen for God's children to see the reality of who they were dealing with before they yoked themselves together with them any further than they already had. God was doing them a favor by going, look at who you're dealing with. Tell them no, they can't help you build and see what happens next. So are you in a relationship with someone who claims to be a Christian, and yet you find that it's a fairly discouraging relationship that troubles your mind and puts fear in your heart and frustration in your life? Because there are some of you who are way too timid to ever cut someone out of your life when you probably should. And you're afraid of doing it for fear of dishonoring God or losing a relationship. But the big question is at what point are you dishonoring God by not cutting them out of your life? Nobody ever asks that. 2 John 1:10 says, if anyone comes to you and doesn't bring this teaching, then don't take them into your house or welcome them. That's pretty stern, and that's New Testament theology. But we're Christians, and we gotta be nice to everybody, and we gotta hope for the best, and we know that they're dangerous people and they're bad for us, but we wanna, you know, give everybody a chance and maybe they'll get saved. Fine. Fine. What are you losing along the way? You better be careful. If you jump ahead to verse 24, very last verse of the chapter, it says, thus the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Just so that you're aware, that verse follows verse 5 chronologically. What we have in verses 6 through 23 happens way later, way decades later. But verse 24 is the cap on verses 1 through 5. So apparently, all of the troubling, the frustration, Satan's new angle on this worked. It worked. They stopped building the temple for, I think it's 16 years. 16 years, these people did nothing for God. Why? Because they wanted to keep good relationships with people who hate God. What a compromise. If Satan can't get you to compromise through friendship, he'll get you to compromise through intimidation and fear. At any rate, verse 6 tells us that in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation. Who's they? Well, it's the Samaritans. They wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. This here is inserted by Ezra to show us that like four or more decades later, when Ahasuerus became king of Persia, after Cyrus, after Darius, after a few others, opposition was still prevalent. These guys are still at it. The Samaritans are still a thorn in their side. Verse 7 continues even further down the line than that. But the reason Ezra makes an effort to put, you know, he goes out of chronological order. The reason he doesn't care about chronology here is because he's not interested in giving us a study of history as much as he is in providing us with a lesson in reality. And the reality is, for us who serve the Lord and do his work, spiritual opposition is going to be a constant, never-ending, perennial challenge for anybody who sets themselves to the work of God in this world. It will always be there. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 11 says, we are not ignorant of Satan's schemes. We know how he works, we know he's not going to give up, and we know he is far more insistent that we give up than we oftentimes are that we continue. So he's not going to stop. In verse 7, we fast forward like another 20 plus years to the days of Artaxerxes. It says, in his days also, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabil, and the rest of their companions wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the letter was written in Aramaic and so forth. And so we see that they're now trying to make accusations against the Jewish people too. In verse 8, we have reason to believe it's actually another letter that was written to that same king, perhaps at a different time, by different people. In verse 8, it's Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe that wrote the letter. And so we just, letters after letters, okay? And for the sake of your understanding, by the time these letters are being written, the temple was finished. Decades and decades and decades have passed, and so the temple was finished being built. but there was still more work to be done. The city had to be rebuilt, the walls had to be rebuilt, and so as long as there was work to be done by God's people, resistance continued to be an issue. Because again, as long as you're doing the work of God, there will be resistance. So don't ever in your Christian life entertain false hopes that opposition and hardship are going to go away once you claim a great spiritual victory or accomplish some great thing for God. You know, like, there, I did it. I, you know, finished school and ministry, or I got my ministry, or got, you know, now I'm doing something for the Lord, or I, you know, led somebody to the Lord, or I, you know, yay, I'm on top. Doesn't matter. All you're really doing by advancing is painting a bigger target on your chest. Satan is not going to quit. As long as you're faithful to keep building, Satan will be sure to keep attacking. And I would add to that, that you might be forewarned that not only will opposition continue, it's probably going to intensify the further you go, as we're going to see here. So in verse 8 now, it's another letter written by Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe. From Rehum, Shimshai, and the rest of their companions, representatives of, and then you have all these people groups. These are all the people that dwelt in Samaria, the Dinaites, the Apharsethites, the Tarpalites, the people of Persia, Erech, Babylon, Shushan, Dehavites, you know, Elamites, just a bunch of them. And they're representing just everybody. So when they write this letter to Artaxerxes, the king, they're going, hey, nobody likes these Jews. I mean, I've talked to everybody and we're all on the same page. They're just troublemakers. So it's everybody against them. So they're building their case before the letter really even starts. And this is a copy of the letter. To King Artaxerxes in verse 11, from your servants, the men of the region beyond the river and so forth, let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you have come to us at Jerusalem and are building the rebellious and evil city, and they're finishing its walls and repairing the foundations. This now is no longer personal. It's become political. They're going to the authorities. They are seeking the rewrite of legislation. They are looking to campaign against the Jews. And so this is now escalated, if you will, to a place that would be very intimidating if you were on the receiving end of it. They say here that the Jews are evil, rebellious. They're finishing the walls, repairing the foundations, all this. It's debatable whether the walls were actually being finished or not, because in the future, Nehemiah would get word that the walls weren't built. They were, in fact, still in ruins. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 3. So, really, were the walls being rebuilt? I mean, maybe. Maybe they were rebuilt and then knocked down again. Some people suggest that. So we don't know whether it's true. If it's not true, it tells us that these men who wrote the letter weren't afraid to exaggerate the details and falsify their report in order to win their case. So, but we'll leave that aside for now. In verse 13, it says that they continued on. Let it now be known to the king that if this city is built, and the walls are completed, they're not going to pay tax, or tribute, or custom, and the king's treasury will be diminished. Now, that is pure conjecture. How they knew that the Jews wouldn't pay tax is beyond me, but they're planting this into the mind of the king in order to give him a sour taste for the people of God. Verse 14, now, because we receive support from the palace, it wasn't proper for us to see the king's dishonor, so we sent and informed you that search may be made in the book of the records of your fathers, and you'll find in the book of the records, and know that this city is rebellious, harmful to kings and provinces, and that they have incited sedition within the city in former times, for which cause this city was destroyed. We inform the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are completed, the result will be that you'll have no dominion beyond the river. You're going to lose all control. And so here in this brief letter, we find that some of the accusations are purely fabricated. Other accusations have their grounds, right? This city is known for sedition, and that's why they were destroyed in the first place. Is that true? Yeah, like you read Kings and Chronicles, you're going to find out that, yeah, the Jews didn't always have it together. So, but what's interesting about this is that the accusers are using just enough truth to validate their lies. Every Christian adversary from the devil on down takes the same strategy. Use just enough truth to validate the lies. You know this about the devil. Satan will accuse you of being evil. Satan will accuse you of being worthless. Satan will accuse you of being undeserving of God's love and bound for hell. Is that true? Is it true that you're evil, worthless, undeserving of God's love, and bound for hell? You know what? Most of it's true. Not the bound for hell part. But evil, yeah, and we can find verses. Worthless, yep, we can find verses. Undeserving of God's love, yep, and we can find verses. But bound for hell, hold on a second. The Bible says that faith in Jesus Christ saves and that it's his work that saves me and not mine. And so therefore, I am saved because I believe. So the devil uses just enough truth to validate the lies and leave you feeling condemned. This is how he works. It's how every adversary from the devil on down does this. So those who wrote the letter are doing it here, and we learn that Satan does it in our lives as well because an adversary is an adversary. Well, the king sent an answer in verse 17 to Rehum the commander, to Shimshai the scribe, to the rest of their companions who dwell in Samaria, and to the remainder beyond the river. Peace, and so forth. The letter which you sent to us has been clearly read before me, and I gave the command, and a search has been made, and it was found that this city in former times has revolted against kings, and rebellion and sedition have been fostered in it. There have also been mighty kings over Jerusalem who have ruled over all the region beyond the river, and tax, tribute, and custom were paid to them. Now give the command to make these men cease, that this city may not be built until the command is given by me. Take heed now that you do not fail to do this. Why should damage increase to the hurt of the kings? Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum, Shimshai the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms made them cease. By force of arms. I'll tell you, this is about as bad as it can get. And this is where this road goes for anybody who continues to do God's work in spite of opposition. It always goes in this direction. The adversary's opposition will intensify. If he can't get you to compromise, he'll try to intimidate. If you can't make you run scared, he'll try to discourage. If he needs to, he can take legal action. He can find his own servants to bring legal action against you for doing God's work. And if that doesn't work, he can get you arrested and perhaps executed. If you read Christian history, you'll find that this is always the trajectory of those who continue to serve God without ceasing. So ask yourself this evening, do you want to keep serving God, or you want to just dabble in it a little bit? And if you just decide to sit on the fringes and dabble in it a little bit, does that make you a Jew or a Samaritan in this scenario? Are you just adding a little Jesus into your life to make it comfortable, or are you all in regardless of the opposition? We're one or the other, aren't we? It's interesting to me that God allowed this to happen. He's sovereign, you know, and he didn't need to. After all, he initiated this return from Babylon by stirring the heart of Cyrus. Do you remember that part? And he brought them all the way back. And they've begun this great work, rebuilding the temple and reinstituting sacrifice, and God is being worshiped again. If God in his sovereignty was able to stir the heart of Cyrus to bring the Jews back, then why would God allow the heart of Artaxerxes to be deceived so that he issued a decree and stopped the whole work? I thought God was in control of the hearts of kings. Doesn't it say in Proverbs that the heart of kings are like water in the Lord's hands, and he turns the hearts of kings wherever he wishes? It does. Why is he allowing Artaxerxes to stop this wonderful work? It's because God's people need to learn how to function in the face of opposition, just like we all do. Why does God allow opposition in your life? Because we have a lot to learn. We need to learn how to keep doing the Lord's work in spite of the attacks. Some of you, you're being opposed, you're being attacked, and you need to wake up and see it for what it is. Nice people are in your life trying to pull you away from the truth. They're trying to dictate the decisions you're making and decide your future for you. And it's leaving you troubled, discouraged, frustrated. It's not healthy. And you need to decide right now what you're going to do with that opposition. Are you going to put an end to it? Or are you going to partner with them anyway? Because if you partner, that's the end of the road. You're done. If you continue on serving the Lord, you will find that Satan's going to take another approach. There's going to be scary things coming. There's going to be all kinds of challenge for you to face, opposition to deal with. And where will it go from there? Well, I think the Bible's pretty clear. All of those who want to live a godly life in Christ Jesus are going to suffer persecution. And Jesus said, if you're not ready to give up your life, you're really not ready to follow me at all. So how far will this go? Only God knows. But it's not our job to determine the future. It's our job to serve the Lord in the present. Satan is our adversary. He's mine and yours. And like the Samaritans, he makes accusations. The Bible says that our adversary makes accusations against us day and night. He accuses the brethren day and night. You know what the problem with Artaxerxes was? He believed those accusations. King Artaxerxes believed those accusations, but Jesus, who is the King of Kings, Artaxerxes had a king too. You know what his name is? Jesus. And unlike Artaxerxes, Jesus doesn't believe any of the accusations that are made against us. So the Samaritans come with this letter going, you know, here's a bunch of facts and you need to believe us and take our word for it and stop what's going on in Jerusalem. And Artaxerxes foolishly goes, oh my, I better stop the work. When accusations are made against us before the Lord, he doesn't buy any of it. He doesn't hold any of our past rebellions against us. He doesn't look in the archives and go, oh, it is true. These people are rebellious and seditious. Like if he looked at your past, what would he find, you guys? And what would it be like if we served a king who held that against you? Oh, I see what they used to be like when they were, you know, in their teens, woo, in their 20s, yeah. I can't let them do this. Jesus goes, no, I know exactly what you were like in your teens, and I was watching you in your 20s, and I was with you in your 30s. Whatever, I know you well enough to know what you're capable of, but I don't hold it against you. And so Jesus, our king, unlike earthly kings, gives us a chance. He doesn't hold our personal failures against us. We have an adversary that's not going to stop. We're going to be opposed and challenged every step of the way. If you want to serve the Lord, you know, this is going to happen. But we need to learn how to deal with that opposition faithfully. Like Zerubbabel, you need to recognize what's going on, have the discernment to see it, and the courage to refuse the offer of help. Be ready to go it alone. Does it mean more work for you? Yep, more work for us. But better that we do it than to dilute the ranks with people who don't love God at all. May the Lord keep this church pure. May the Lord keep your family pure. May the Lord keep your mind pure. May the Lord keep your life free of relationships and partnerships that would drag you down because you were too undiscerning or too afraid to make a decision for yourself.